What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
What's stopping you?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion on this Friday afternoon. Delighted to have you with us. As you know by now, if you've been listening for a while, this is a program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. Love to answer those questions from folks just like you who want to know something about the Catholic faith, but we're really not quite sure where to go for the proper answer. We are not going to be taking your phone calls today because we're doing a special mailbag edition of our show. The mailbag is getting a little bit heavy. We kind of need a little forklift to lift the thing. I mean, it's really getting heavy. So we're going to try to answer as many emailed questions today as we possibly can. Our producer, Pedro Quiles. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I'm well. Are you ready for the mailbag?
I am ready. Let's go.
We're going to begin with this one from John, who says, I don't understand where we find penance in Scripture. In the Bible, Jesus forgives but does not ask for anything. Why do priests give penance?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, first of all, I beg to differ that Christ doesn't ask for anything. I think he asks a whole lot. I mean, you remember what the rich young ruler, when he came to Christ and said, good teacher, what must I do to be saved? Christ says, okay, we'll obey the commandments. And he says, well, I got that, check. Okay, what's next? He says, oh, well, you want something else? How about sell everything that you have and come and give to the poor and come and follow me.
Ouch.
Right? That's kind of a biggie there.
Yes.
You remember Zacchaeus? Jesus goes and he meets Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus is up a tree, literally, and he says, come down, I'm going to eat at your house today. And comes down, he eats at Zacchaeus' house, and Zacchaeus says, dear Lord Jesus, I know that I'm a sinner and I can't save myself, so please come into my heart and forgive me for my sins. Amen. And Jesus says, you're off scot-free. Okay, you're going to heaven. You've been saved. And that's not what happened. Zacchaeus says, I'm sorry.
Yes.
And then he makes amends. He says, I'm gonna give half of what I have to the poor and pay sevenfold to anybody I've defrauded. And then Jesus says, now salvation has come to this house.
Now you're
right?
Talking.
Now you're talking, right? So it's not true that Jesus asks nothing, and it's not true that a mere expression of belief or request for forgiveness is adequate in Jesus' books. And in Matthew's gospel, in chapter 25, on the last day, Christ says, many people will come to me and say, Lord, Lord, and he'll say, I'll never knew you, because you didn't give drink to the thirsty or clothes to the naked or visit the sick or the imprisoned, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just not true that Christ asks nothing. But as far as the specific content of penance is concerned, two illustrations from Scripture that I always like to go to, they're very illustrative, are from the episode Life of King David, two episodes in David's life, 2 Samuel 12 and 2 Samuel 24. They're places where David has sinned grievously. He's confronted by a prophet. He acknowledges his fault. He asks for forgiveness. He is forgiven, and then God imposes a penance. He says, okay, here's what you have to do to make it up to me. Now, from Catholic theological perspective, penance does not earn our reconciliation with God. One does not do penance in order to get God's forgiveness. One does penance because one has already acquired God's forgiveness, right? And it's in a relationship. Think about this. Like, say you offend your wife, God forbid, and you come in and say, I'm sorry. And she says, okay, I forgive you. Well, if you're a halfway decent husband, what do you do at that point?
I know what I do.
Yeah, you run off and you get the flowers or the chocolate or the dinner invitation or whatever.
Like, all three.
Right. Now, is that the price of reconciliation with your wife? Well, I hope not.
No.
I hope not, right? It's the consequence of reconciliation with your life. And that's the idea. That's the idea.
All right. John, thanks so much for your email. Here's one now from Beth asking two questions here. How can souls already be in heaven or purgatory? And how can they rise from their graves at the last judgment?
Yeah. Okay, thanks. So, first of all, when we talk about souls being in heaven, In the New Testament's perspective, the idea of going to heaven when you die is muted at best, possibly absent, in that the perspective of the New Testament is almost entirely oriented towards the future resurrection of the dead. And a good illustration of this would be in St. Paul's first letter to the Thessalonians, because the Thessalonians were confident of the imminent return of Jesus. Like, any day now, Jesus is coming back.
Yeah.
And some of their number had died, and they were afraid that, well, they've missed out. Now, the easiest thing for Paul to have said would be, oh, well, don't worry, they're with Jesus now in heaven. But he doesn't say that. What he says is, don't worry, they're going to rise from the dead when he comes back. Right, and that's really the orientation of the Bible. So the question, what does happen to the soul as we are awaiting the second coming of Jesus, is one that the church works out over time. And what the church now teaches is that what happens to the souls of the just is that they experience the beatific vision. Now, they don't, as it were, go to a place called heaven, because that would suggest that the soul is some kind of quasi-material substance that can be located in some sort of space-time coordinates,
yeah,
right? And God isn't, right? God is not more here than there, right? God is not, there's not more of God in an elephant than in a mouse, and he's not, like, you know, more on one side of the street than the other. God's not spatially located. Neither is the separated soul. Right, you wouldn't say that, you know, that his soul is to my left. That's a meaningless statement,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So in some way that is obscure to us, the disembodied soul, which doesn't have a body and therefore has no temporal spatial location, well, it's temporal, but has no spatial location, has an experience of God, which is an intuitive knowledge of God in his essence, without the medium of a body, but it is an incomplete experience that is awaiting the resurrection. And that's what the church says about the thing.
Okay.
How does that happen? Well, you know, you will win more than the Nobel Prize for Physics if you can figure that one out.
You get maybe a couple of those. Maybe after the break here, we can answer that other question about rising from the graves at the last judgment.
Oh, yeah, sure.
We'll tackle that. We'll also get to another few questions here. We have a very interesting one from Deborah. We'll get to that as well. It's a special mailbag edition for Call to Communion today on this Friday afternoon on EWTN. Do stay with us. Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews on this Friday afternoon. Not taking your calls today because we're answering a whole bunch of questions from the EWTN mailbag. If you would like to send us a question for a future show, here's the address, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. You've probably heard the phrase, EWTN is everywhere. Well, by golly, it is. It's also available on Instagram. Just go to Instagram, search EWTN Radio, and if you like what you see, we invite you to follow us there on Instagram for great short video content. And of course, EWTN is indeed everywhere. Here's that question from Deborah that we were talking about. Deborah says, I have been and am drawn to the Catholic faith. However, I'm reluctant to become a Catholic because I feel it would be hypocritical of me to do so, as I do not support various areas, abortion, IBF, same-sex relationship, divorce, have marriage annulled, in order to become a Catholic. I am a baptized Christian as a preteen, but I don't attend church, as various churches that I have gone to don't set right with me. So, how can I move forward with becoming a Catholic, knowing that I don't agree with the church's social views? Thanks, Deborah.
Yes, I really appreciate the question. So, if you are open to reading some theological distinctions, I would recommend that you look at a document called the Commentary on the Professio Fidei. Commentary on the Profession of Faith, Commentary on the Professio Fidei, which was promulgated under John Paul II when Joseph Ratzinger, who became Pope Benedict, was the head of that congregation. And it goes into very specific detail about what you actually have to hold with the assent of faith when you profess the Catholic faith. And essentially, and it's more nuanced than I'm going to give you, so I recommend you look at it. But here's what it boils down to. You have to believe what the Church says is divinely revealed by God, right? And you have to give your assent to the that which is sort of logically entailed by those things. So you have the assent of faith in the dogma, and then you agree to, which is a slightly different intellectual act, things that would be logically entailed by that, okay? But when it comes to the question of policy, when the Church advocates a policy position, you don't have to make the assent of divine and supernatural faith. Instead, you have to do something called offer the religious submission of mind and will. And with the caveat that you recognize that when it comes to policy prescriptions, the Church can get it wrong. It doesn't get the dogmas wrong. It doesn't get those wrong. That's what infallibility guarantees. But it can be imprudent in its policy. And so how does this shake out? Like, what does religious submission of mind and will look like? Let me give you a concrete illustration of something a little bit less controversial. Let's say you're in parish life. The priest, he is not single-handedly the magisterium of the Church, but he participates in the Church's magisterium because he participates in the Church's teaching office.
Mm-hmm.
When the parish priest gets up on Sunday morning and he proclaims a dogma of the Catholic faith, let's say it's the Feast of Corpus Christi, and he gets up in the ambo for his homily, and he says, okay, today I'm going to explain to you the dogma of the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. And he reads it out. You know, sometimes I've been watching the homilies on EWTN, and you'll see some of the friars, they'll literally read to you from the catechism, right? Here it is. This is what the Church teaches, all right? You got to believe that, all right? If it's a dogma, you got to believe that, all right? And then he says, and oh, by the way, I've decided that the women's Bible study is going to get to use the family room on Tuesday nights. He says this not during the homily, but at the end of Mass. And the Knights of Columbus, they're not going to get it until Thursday night. And you sit back and you go, wait a minute. but the Knights have this other conflict on Thursday, and that's the only night they can meet. And I think Father made a really dumb call here by letting the women's Bible study use it on Tuesday night and making the Knights wait till Thursday. And that was a bad decision. All right. Well, you're allowed to think that. You're allowed to think he made a bad call. Right? Religious submission of mind and will means, okay, he made a bad call, but he's the priest and I'm not, so he gets to make the bad call.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm stuck with it because he's the priest and I'm not, and I'm respectful. Then I'm not going to stand up in the church and like heckle him or something, you know? But I don't have to agree that he made the right call. And there are lots of occasions in Catholic history when popes and bishops have made calls that have been imprudent, and in hindsight, we look back and go, well, that was astronomically stupid, right? I mean, really, seriously, they've done some humdingers in history. And we can look back and go, well, those were really stupid calls. And sometimes their interventions, say, in the political and social sphere can really go awry. Like, they can have good intentions, but they can advocate policies in a certain way that are really, like, not good, okay? And so what that means for some of the sensitive issues that you mentioned is, all right, so if the Church says, for example, that abortion is gravely wrong, well, you're obligated as a Catholic to think that it's gravely wrong. Does that mean you are obligated to support anything that an allegedly pro-life platform by a particular political party advocates in policy to advance that objective? And your assent, no, you don't. Like you don't have to be a card-carrying member of party X, Y, or Z just because they bandy about, like, a Catholic slogan. You follow what I'm saying?
Sure.
You have to believe the dogma. Mm-hmm. You don't have to believe what the local policymaker says he thinks is entailed by the dogma in every case. I mean, there are cases when the fit is going to be pretty tight, but there are other cases where it's not so tight, and you're allowed to hold a divergent point of view. So I could go into more detail, but that's the idea. But go read the commentary on the Professio Fidei. I think it might give you some wiggle room in there where you can make an act of faith.
Deborah, thanks so much for your email. We're doing a special mailbag edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. This one from John, who says, did Martin Luther suffer from scrupulosity?
Yes, in a huge way. Yes, I don't think there's any dispute about that among historians, Catholic or Protestant. Luther really, really, really liked his confessor when he was a Catholic. It was a fellow by the name of Johann von Staupitz. And Staupitz was a pretty good guy. And Staupitz grew so frustrated with Luther in the confessional because Luther would come in and just confess these. I mean, they weren't even peccadilloes. I mean, they weren't even morally relevant issues. He was just confessing all kinds of stuff. And he got so frustrated one time, he said, Luther, I wish you would, like, go kill somebody or commit adultery or something so you'd have something decent to confess, because quit bringing me this garbage that you're bringing me. This is not confessional matter. You're not in sin, my friend, you know. And that's the evidence of a highly, highly, highly scrupulous soul, yeah, to be sure.
Sure.
And Luther was intensely introspective. Jared Wicks wrote a book called... Man Yearning for Grace, which is an intellectual study of the thought of the very, very early Luther, like the pre-Reformation Luther, the Catholic Luther. And when you read that book, which I have, you find that Luther took some positions, made some statements that are not good Catholic theology. They're not good Catholic theology, but they do give some evidence to the state of his soul. And so one I remember in particular, Luther said, and this is not good Catholic theology, he said, to someone who wants to be saved, they should act like no one else in the world exists. They need to just zero in and focus in on their own soul and not think about anybody else. Well, that's not true. I mean, like, you're saved by loving other people and thinking about them and taking up their concerns. But I mean, that's how, like, introspectively, neurotically focused he was, and it gave evidence and sort of bore fruit in this deep scrupulosity that manifested in the confessional. Now, one consequence of that is that when Luther began to work out his Reformation theology, he took his own religious experience as normative for everybody, and so he worked out a theology of redemption wherein one necessarily comes to a kind of scrupulous, neurotic, like deeply self-critical, self-hating kind of experience of sin, and then one is liberated from that, you know, allegedly into his experience of free grace, as if every Catholic would experience the confessional as the same torture chamber that he did, and that's clearly not the case, but it became a trope in Reformation propaganda. So Luther's characterization of his own interior life, and how he said one time, he says, I went where my anfechtung took me. I went where my grief, my anxiety, my depression carried me. It wasn't reading and studying. It was dying and being damned that made me a theologian. He used that kind of language. And so when you read other Protestant theologians, like Calvin, for example, Calvin did not have Luther's scrupulous conscience at all, but he really glommed on to the caricature that the Catholic Church created these crises of conscience. And so when you read his polemics, he's always writing, the confessional, it creates all these neurotic consciences and people are in doubt about their salvation and their anxiety all the time. Even though Calvin's own life didn't evidence that, and interestingly, when Calvin was in ministry in Geneva, his big problem was not people who had scrupulous consciences. It was the opposite. He had people that were like, we don't have to listen to you, Calvin, you know, and we're not going to quit dancing and drinking and carrying on and partying and naming our children after Catholic saints or whatever we want to do. And he was like, these libertines, they have no conscience, right? And so because of Luther's neurotic conscience, it entered into sort of Protestant historiography that all Catholics necessarily have scrupulous consciences like that, and it's just not the case.
Okay. John, thanks so much for your email. We're not taking your phone calls today. It's a special mailbag edition of Call to Communion on this Friday afternoon on EWTN. Fascinating question here from Mark. When would it be licit to defend the faith physically, although unpopular? Without the Crusades, Western civilization as we know it wouldn't exist. What say you, Doctor?
I don't think it's ever legitimate to defend the faith physically. I think it's legitimate to defend one's family, to defend one's country, sometimes to defend one's property.
Yeah.
I don't know how you would abstract out the question of faith exclusively And then how, I don't know what physical act could defend it.
Well, he's talking about the Crusades.
Yeah, I understand that. I understand that. Okay. But I'm saying, like, you know, in the Crusades, it's not just the faith that was at issue, right? It was literally the existence of Western civilization as a society, right? That was at issue, because you had Saracen and invaders. You had Muslim invaders that are literally like pushing into Europe and trying to conquer geographic territory. And so the Crusaders are like, well, you know, we've got to take up arms and defend ourselves, or we're going to be destroyed as a people, right?
Okay.
And so that's not just the faith that's being defended. I mean, they do construe it in religious terms, but I mean, it's the homeland. It's my family. It's our liberty. It's our property. I mean, these are the things we're fighting to preserve, and the right to practice our faith. Because if you were under Muslim domination, there were extreme censures placed on what you can actually do in the public sphere as a practicing Catholic. And, you know, in those days, Christianity was woven into the constitution of states. And so we have a different conception today, but I mean that, you know, there to eliminate the faith would be also to eliminate, you know, a whole order of society. And so there's more at stake than just the abstract question of belief.
Very good. Mark, thanks so much for your email and this one from William. How does the biblical timeline work with the different gospels?
Oh, not well at all.
No?
Not well at all. Yeah. So I think it's very, very difficult to try to work out a chronology of the life of Christ based on the Gospels. I mean, people have done it. You know, there is a, you know, there were harmonies of the Gospels that were composed in antiquity were very popular in some places. You know, these compilations where people would kind of mush the four Gospels together and try to create a narrative were more popular than the individual Gospels themselves. But I think modern biblical scholars don't think that those reconstructions were at all accurate. And it's pretty evident that the Synoptic Gospel writers rearranged the stories according to their own literary criterion, not according to their any kind of temporal sequence.
Very good. Appreciate that. It is called Communion here on EWTN. Sam sent us this email. Is it true to say that God the Father was born of Mary?
No, not at all. No, it's not true to say that God the Father was born of Mary, nor does one say that God the Father died on the cross. And the born of Mary thing wasn't much of an issue in Catholic history. But the Father dying on the cross was something that was specifically contemplated and rejected in the second century.
Really?
And it was called the heresy of patripassionism.
Wow.
Patripassionism, meaning the death of the Father, right? So the dogma of the Incarnation is not that the Father assumed a human nature. That is not the dogma of the Incarnation. The dogma of the Incarnation is the Son assumed a human nature. So God died on the cross. God was born of the Blessed Virgin Mary, but not the Father.
Okay, clear that is. Sam, thanks so much for your email. If you're thinking about giving us a call this afternoon, you may want to think twice about that, because we're not taking those calls. We're instead doing a special mailbag edition of our program here on EWTN. Let me give you that address once again if you would like to send us an email for a future show. ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. We will be back taking your live phone calls on Monday. So if you've got a great question, you don't want to wait around for an email, well, hang in there over the weekend and call us on Monday. In the meantime, we're doing a special mailbag edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Do stay with us. Glad you're with us on this Friday afternoon here on Call to Communion. We are not taking your phone calls. We're doing a special mailbag edition of the program. And it seems like every time we do a program, I learn something. And today I learned how to pronounce a word that I, A, didn't know how to pronounce, B, had never heard of before. So we're going to get to this one from Daniel. Daniel says, is there a possibility that Armageddon refers to Mount Carmel in the Valley of Megiddo and Elijah's battle with the false prophets, and therefore also a reference to the Trinity being the only true and triumphant God.
Thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, I confess that the geographical reference of the Book of Revelation are obscure to me, and I had to actually take classes in Israel and Judea geography
when
I was in seminary and map all those places out. But that was a long time ago, and I have some vague ideas of where things fall, but that's not me. That Father Mitch, however, is really good with geography. He's been to the Holy Land about a bazillion times and knows where everything is. But in terms of the primacy of the one God, the God of the Bible, is clearly in view, right, in the Book of Revelation.
Okay. Thanks so much for your question. Here's one now from Ricardo. My Methodist friends asked me if I could be a godparent for their baby. Can I accept?
Thanks so much. I'm not aware of anything in canon law that would prevent you from doing that. The task of a godparent is to try to help the young person come to live their Christian faith with generosity and wisdom. And, if they're going to raise their child as a Methodist, and so your objective as a Catholic would be obviously not to endorse the elements of Methodism that specifically conflict with the Catholic faith, but to encourage him in the practice of his Methodist faith insofar as it is in accord with the Catholic faith. One thing that the Methodist tradition has put a heavy emphasis on is the social aspect of the gospel, that we have a moral obligation to try to better the world and the life of our neighbor and engage in the challenging and unjust structures and putting structures and institutions into place that can help further the common good. That's a very big part of the Methodist tradition. That's something Catholics definitely believe in as well. The Methodist tradition has drawn a lot from the Catholic tradition, and Wesley was himself deeply influenced by the Catholic mystical tradition, and so some of his thoughts on interior life and soteriology, that's say the doctrine of salvation and the life of prayer, showed definite evidences of Catholic influence. So those are things that you can highlight in your understanding of his practice of Methodism. And, the Second Vatican Council speaks about the elements of truth and sanctification that we can find in non-Catholic traditions, and points out that these can be forces that impel to Catholic unity. And, my own life is an example. I grew up Presbyterian, and, the most evident piece of element of truth and sanctification that we possessed was most of the Bible. Not the whole Bible, but we had 66 books of the Bible. Well, reading the Bible made me a Catholic, among other things. So, I mean, I thought it was a Presbyterian book, but it was, lo and behold, we snuck a Catholic book in there, right? And so they're all reading a Catholic book, and not a few Protestants have become Catholic by reading the Catholic Bible in their non-Catholic church, right?
Yeah.
And the same thing can happen, a Methodist can discover elements of his Methodist tradition and say, hey, where these things come from? Oh, they came from the Catholic Church. I had a good friend that became Catholic as he was engaged in the pro-life cause. And he started studying the thing and realized, well, the Catholics are the most pro-life thing going. And he, ultimately was drawn into Catholicism through that element of truth and sanctification that impelled to Catholic unity.
Ricardo, thanks so much for your question. It's a mailbag edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN Radio. This one from Uriah, who says, Dr. Anders, in reading the book of Hebrews, I can see where Luther found it troubling. I myself have had bouts of scrupulosity going over the text. It seems as though the author is making it clear that for those who have fallen away and try to come back, there is no room for redemption. Could you speak on this contradiction and how best not to fall into a scrupulous state?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So first of all, what is the context of the book of Hebrews? Clearly, what the author of Hebrews has in view is the sin of apostasy. That's what he has in view.
Okay.
That's not what you have in view, right? I mean, if you're telling me you're scrupulous about your faith, scrupulous people are not worried about, oh, gosh, I just denied Christ publicly three times in front of the whole world and said, I'm not a Catholic and I'm totally renouncing the faith and I'm running away. Like, that's not what you're complaining about. That's not what you're worried about. I know it's not, right? Otherwise, I mean, you wouldn't be writing my show talking about your scrupulosity if you had just completely renounced Catholicism, right? And that is what's in view in the book of Hebrews. The writer is saying, look, apostasy is the sin that he's trying to guard against. That's not what you did. So you can put your mind at ease about that. Secondly, you know, I mean, empirically, when people do that with their Catholic faith, it's really hard to get them back. I mean, it is much harder to reach an ex-Catholic than a non-Catholic. It is, objectively, right? Because they think, hey, you know, I did the Catholic thing, been there, done that. I know what you guys have to say. I don't need to hear it again. Now, my view is, no, you didn't, and yes, you do, right? but they didn't really, but they think they did. And so they're very hard to reach. Yeah. I mean, empirically, what the writer of Hebrews says, I think it can be borne out that when people apostatize and walk away from the church, it's very, very difficult to get them back, right? But you're right. Like, the text has a very stark sound to it. And because of this, there was a big controversy in second century Christianity over the question you're worried about, namely, if a person sins mortally, not just apostasy, although that was clearly in view, but murder, adultery, this kind of thing, can they be reconciled to the church? Now, today, as Catholics, we're like, yeah, of course you can. You know, no big deal. Well, big deal, but not no big deal getting you back in. It's very easy to get back in, right?
Right.
But it wasn't like that in the second century. There was a big chunk of people that thought that if you sinned mortally after baptism, you had one shot. That you could go to confession, you could receive absolution and do penance one time. But that if you did it again, then you were just out and you could never come back. And this was the controversy over the second repentance. That was what it was called.
Mm.
And so the Shepherd of Hermas, Clement of Alexandria, Tertullian of Carthage, among others, were people that took kind of a hard line on this. And Tertullian got into a fight with Pope Calixtus about it. And Calixtus said, no. Look, Jesus said, how often am I supposed to forgive my neighbor? Once, twice, seven times? No, 70 times seven. I mean, infinite. Like, you never stop forgiving. You always reconcile. And that was the Pope's position. And made Tertullian really mad, made him so mad that he left the Catholic Church over and became a Montanist, right? And interestingly, out of that controversy, one of the earliest witnesses to the doctrine of papal jurisdiction is we found actually in the mouth of Tertullian. He writes the Pope and he says, Pope, you're wrong. But I know what you're going to say, Pope. You're going to say that you sit on the chair of Peter and that what you bind on earth is bound in heaven. But let me tell you something, Pope. You got another thing coming, right? It's interesting, isn't it? Tertullian, who left the church, actually articulated the papal doctrine perfectly and then rejected it. Why did he reject it? Because the Pope wanted to forgive people. The Pope wanted to forgive people, and Tertullian didn't want to forgive people.
Wow. Wow. Amazing. Hey, thank you so much for your question. It is called a communion here on EWTN. Here's one now from Shady, who says, Dr. Anders, I was watching a Catholic Q&A program. A question was asked about the Last Supper that I've never heard about. The question, did Jesus celebrate the Passover a day early? The host of this program said there was controversy over this. He believed that the Last Supper was not a traditional Mosaic meal, and there was no lamb, as they would have been killed the next day. So, was the Passover and Sabbath on the same day? Could this be a confusion? Please comment. Thanks, Shady.
Yeah, there's ambiguity about this in the Bible. The synoptics give one story. John gives another story.
Ah.
And there's a great discussion of it in Pope Benedict's book, Jesus of Nazareth, Volume 2, where he lays out what all the options are to resolving it. But the text itself, there is an ambiguity, that's to be sure.
Okay. Sonia wants to know, why did Jesus tell Mary that it was, quote, not his time at the wedding at Cana?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. So, you know, in John chapter 6, we read that the crowds followed Jesus because they had seen the miracles that he'd done. And, of course, we think of John chapter 6 as the great passage on Christ's presence in the Eucharist, which it is. So he lays out this teaching on the Eucharist, but not before the crowds who have come following him because of his signs and wonders want to make him king by force. That's what the text tells us. They wanted to take him and make him king by force. So, you know, he nixed that one in the bud pretty quick. He says, well, you have to eat my flesh and drink my blood. And they're like, ooh, maybe we don't want this guy as a king after all, you know. But the point was that they misinterpreted the signs, right? They assessed their importance the wrong way. You know, Christ said in the Gospel of Matthew, a wicked and adulterous generation asks for a sign. You know, the miracles of Christ in sacred scripture, they're everywhere, but they're different in some respects than we have come to think about them, I believe. Sometimes they are a challenge. The miracle itself is a challenge to the proper interpretation of Jesus, just as it was in the case in John 6, where people say, hey, this guy's powerful. He can beat up Romans. Let's make him king. And Jesus says, you're missing the point, bud. You're missing the point. You remember the Pharisees saw the miracles of Christ, and Jesus says, look, if I cast out demons by the finger of God, then you know the kingdom of God has come among you. And they said, well, okay, he does miracles, but it must be by Beelzebub, the king of the prince of demons, because we can't be following this guy. So the miracles themselves are not self-attesting, right? They're not self-interpreting. They can be ambiguous. The Pharisees construed them as a sign of evil. The people construed them as the sign of political and military power, right? It's not obvious how they're meant to be taken. And of course, you know, the ultimate way they're meant to be taken is they arrest our attention, they draw our attention to Christ, but for what? Jesus tells us in the Gospel of Mark, if you want to be my disciple, you have to take up your cross and follow me, right? So, you know, it wasn't time for Christ to let his identity be known and to have the true scope of his mission laid out. This is something that develops in the Gospels. He has to gather a company of disciples. He has to shape them. He has to mentor them for 3 years. The secrets of the kingdom of heaven have been given to you, he says to the apostles, but not to them, not to those on the outside. Like, he's got to build an organization, and he's got to bring people into a proper understanding of the gospel, which take the disciples a long time to do, because even at the very end, after he's died and risen from the dead, they say, Lord, are you at this time going to restore the kingdom to Israel? And you can just see resurrected Jesus going,
thunderheads.
They still don't get it. Jesus says in Gospel of Luke, Matthew chapter 17, don't say, here's the kingdom, there's the kingdom, for the kingdom of God is within you, right? So it had to develop. He had to lay out the whole case. He had to demonstrate it with his life, and especially by his death and resurrection.
Sonia, thank you so much for your question. We're doing a special mailbag edition of Call to Communion on this Friday afternoon here on EWTN. Let me tell you about one of the great podcasts we have for you on EWTN's Podcast Central. It's called the Dr. Ray Podcast. Now, this is not Ray's daily question and answer show where people call in, he answers questions. No. This is a little bit different. The Dr. Ray Podcast talks about parenting issues, from diaper dilemmas to teenage traumas to college crises. He tackles family, personal, and professional life issues in a straightforward and, of course, because it's Dr. Ray, always humorous way. You can hear this and other faith-filled podcasts at EWTN's Podcast Central. Visit EWTN.com/podcasts today. So here's a great question that we received from Helen in China. Don't hear too many questions from China. Glad to get to Helen today. Helen says, Tom and Dr. Anders, my daughter and I are both practicing Catholics. Recently, she shared with me a philosophical idea of the, quote, leap of faith by Soren Kierkegaard, which she finds interesting. To me, this idea sounds more closely to the Protestant way of thinking. I'd be grateful if you could elaborate on this concept, leap of faith, and clarify how it differs from Catholic philosophical viewpoint. Thanks and God bless, Helen in China.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So Kierkegaard is a profound and interesting thinker, and I have learned things from Kierkegaard. I appreciate Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard was a Lutheran, by tradition, and and his religious philosophy does not map perfectly onto the Catholic faith, right? So Kierkegaard had this idea of a kind of spiritual evolution of the human person, where one passes from a kind of aesthetic phase of life to an ethical phase of life to a religious phase of life, and that they're conceptually distinct. And interestingly, he differentiates the ethical from the religious. That's a key point there. Because, and this is based on, I mean, I think a kind of genuine insight, but maybe he takes it too starkly, that, you know, a person can have an ethical life in the sense that they do what is proper, right, you know, without ever confronting, how should I put it, the sort of awesome, numinous mystery of God, right? And there's a kind of socially acceptable ethical life where you do what's expected of you and you pay your taxes and this kind of thing that can become an obstacle to the transcendent because you can become self-satisfied in it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think Kierkegaard knew that. He also was reacting against Hegelian philosophy. And in Hegel's philosophical schema, you could construct a kind of perfectly rational account of everything, right? That you could have but it was one that lacked existential significance. I mean, it made logical sense, but it didn't, at the end of the day, Kierkegaard's criticism of Hegel's system is he said Hegel made a system and sat down beside it, you know? And we've all met that guy, not Hegel specifically, but you've met the guy who can reason out everything, you know, to a fine pitch, you know, to fine point. And then at the end of the day, you're like, yeah, but what difference does it make in your life? Because I don't much like you, right? I mean, I don't like how you live, and I don't want to enter into your little thought world that you've created because it's an ugly place to be, right? And so Kierkegaard posited, well, there's something beyond the mere aesthetic or hedonistic life, and there's something beyond the life of a kind of, you know, sort of basic humdrum moral conformity. And there's something beyond mere ratiocination in our grasp. So there must be, you know, there's some other kind of existential move that takes us into the realm of the numinous and the confrontation with mystery that is God. And so, you know, for Kierkegaard, sort of the ultimate symbol of the religious dimension of life would be God's demand to Abraham that he sacrifice Isaac, because it violates any kind of ethical consideration that we would have. I mean, one does not kill one's own son to offer in sacrifice to deities. I mean, and that the unimaginable horror of that strikes us if you think about it very long. And of course, you know, Kierkegaard wrote a book about it, Fear and Trembling. I think it was Fear and Trembling about that, right? And he says, but you know, that kind of thing is the real pass, you know, beyond the veil into the radical other that is God. And so, you know, I think there are elements of truth in Kierkegaard's position, and I mentioned some of them, right? But at the end of the day, one last element of truth I'll say, and that is that the Catholic faith teaches that faith cannot be compelled through argument. In fact, the First Vatican Council said that if you think that you can compel another person's intellect to accept the dogmas of the Catholic faith by presenting lock-solid deductive argument to them, you're actually a heretic, right? That faith is a supernatural act. It comes as a gift of grace, and it can't be compelled in that way, right? You know, Hegel can make systems all day long, but they're not going to make you believe the Catholic faith, okay? So that element is true in Kierkegaard. Here are some places where I think that a Catholic would be uncomfortable. First of all, we don't want to draw the kind of radical distinction that he draws between the ethical and the religious. I think a better way to think of it is that, you know, Christ himself criticized the what passed for ethics in his day. He criticized what passed for acceptable religious life in his day, and he inverted the orders of society. You know, the first were last, and the last were first, and it's the tax collectors and the prostitutes are entering the kingdom before you guys, and that sort of thing is part of Jesus's. So he definitely is willing to criticize that, but not because he wanted to pass beyond the ethical, but he wanted to get to the true ethical, right? Which is the love of God and neighbor, and mm-hmm. and recognizing that everybody has dignity, and that I have to go to that person and love them as Christ does, right? Uh-huh. It's a deeper conception of the ethical, not the cutting off of the ethical. And then while faith is a gift, it's not necessarily a leap in the sense that Kierkegaard suggests, because there are reasons for faith. There are motives for faith in the Catholic tradition. They're called the motives of credibility.
Mm-hmm.
And so yes, there is something wrong with just logic chopping and system building for its own sake, but it doesn't mean we can't construct arguments for faith. We do, right? We do.
Sure.
And faith has a logic and an intelligibility to it. Now, you know, that all being said, Kierkegaard is sometimes credited as being the father of existentialism. And you know, existentialism as a movement focuses on the radical importance of choice in human life. And Charles Taylor, the philosopher and historian and sociologist, wrote a book called The Secular Age about the process of secularization. And he makes the argument that if you'd lived, say, 1,500 years ago or 500 years ago, to not be religious would almost not even be possible for you to conceive of. Hmm. Wouldn't even occur to you to not be religious. Today, the not religious option is everywhere.
Oh yeah,
it's very easy to get there. Like we're very conscious of the fact that one chooses to take a religious perspective or to live a religious life. And in that respect, I think the existentialists were right to focus in on the question of, at the end of the day, you have to make a choice to adopt a mode of life and to own it and to be authentic about it and to be honest with yourself about, okay, I am electing to be a Catholic and to live in the world as a Catholic. It's not something I'm doing just because my parents have given this to me or my culture has, you know, sort of forced or brainwashed me into it or whatever mm-hmm. have you. I'm choosing to step into the world and to see things as a Catholic would see them. And that's an existential insight. And I think that kind of philosophy can awaken us to the severity and the seriousness of that kind of choice. But again, yeah, he's not Catholic.
Did Kierkegaard, did he actually coin the phrase leap of faith?
He did, in fact.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, there it is. And Helen, we're delighted that you're listening to us in China. Thank you so much for your question. Glenn wants to know, why would God create the tree of knowledge in the Garden of Eden if Adam and Eve were not meant to eat from it? What's wrong with knowledge?
Yeah, thank you. It's a great question. I really appreciate the question. So I don't think we should think of the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil as literal biological organisms, right?
Okay.
And most of the fathers don't. They think these are obviously symbolic representations of modes of being, right? Not physical objects, right? So it's get that idea out of your head.
Okay.
So what is the temptation here, right? Well, the temptation would be the experiential knowledge of evil, right? That you know, Adam and Eve, and look, we've all faced this. You know, we've all faced this. You know, you learn abstractly, well, X is wrong, and you're like, yeah, but is it really? You know, I want to find out for myself. I want to taste some of that. Surely once wouldn't be too bad. You know, once is too bad, right? And I think that's a perennial part of human experience, right? That sometimes we go against our better judgment and the counsel of our elders and betters and those that know more than we do, and we say, I need to taste the experience of evil to know for myself that it's bad. And the pernicious thing about evil is that sometimes it's exactly in the tasting that the thing that's so bad about it is hidden from you.
Wow.
Right? So think about, I know I always go to this as an illustration, but it's just so helpful. Think about the dynamic of drug addiction, right? What makes drug addiction so terrible? Or Mark Lewis, the neuroscientist, has pointed out that when you're an addict, what happens is your sphere of attention gets narrowed and narrowed and narrowed and narrowed to where the only thing you can see is the drug.
Yeah.
And so you literally become blind to all of the good things and people in your life that you're destroying, because the only thing you can see is the drug. And if you've ever known somebody who is an addict, that is exactly what happens, right?
Oh, yeah.
But what happens when you go in to experience it for yourself? Well, the first-time drug user takes the drug and says, oh, I've never felt this good in my life. What did they were all lying to me when they said this was bad. But what they don't know is that they've just blinded themselves to all of these other good things in life. right? And they become incapable of engaging in anything but the drug, right? That's a pretty good metaphor for why seeking the knowledge of good and evil on your own could be a really dangerous thing.
Glenn, thanks so much.
Blindness is one of the effects of original sin.
Glenn, thank you so much for your question. Fast-moving program today with EWTN's Mailbag on Call to Commune. Dr. David Anders, have a great weekend.
Thank you, Tom.
Hope that everybody has a great weekend. Be sure to join us on Monday for another live program. Coming up next on most of these stations, Open Line Friday with our friend Colin Donovan. Until then, have a wonderful weekend yourself, and we'll see you again on the Monday edition of Call to Communion. I'm Tom Price. Have a great weekend, and God bless.